Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Here in the studio today, our co-host, Russ Chianelli, and we're going to be talking about material science. In particular, you know, you've heard this word before, nanostructural material science. So we've got two key little areas of interest merging together. So our guest is Dr. Sarah Talbot. She's a professor of chemistry. I call her a material scientist.
I'm also a professor of material science.
Oh, and also, there you are. And she's not going to be reticent in talking about herself. She's at UCLA. And Sarah, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Right. So you got two positions. Do you get paid twice?
No. That would be lovely, but no.
Okay. Now, before we get into you as a material scientist and as a female material scientist, let's talk a little bit about what you were like when you were about 6 or 7 or 17. What were those moments that you suddenly
said? How did you get interested in this at a young age?
I don't know. I was always interested in it. I was the kind of kid who would, like, go out to the mountains and go fishing and then come home and cut up the fish and look at all the pieces inside.
Mm-hmm. Did you find any interesting pieces that you didn't know were there?
There's a lot of very bright colors inside a fish. And since the fish I caught were usually about 4 inches long, they weren't very good for eating. So they were pretty much only good for cutting up.
Did you used to put bait on the hooks, or is it with a net?
No, I put bait on the hooks, but I was not a particularly adept fisher person.
Well, where was this river that you fished in?
I grew up in the foothills of the Rockies in Colorado, so
okay.
Wherever I could find a stream or a lake, but I didn't have any particularly good. Now I have some friends who are expert trout fishermen, and I know how much I didn't know at the time, and how little chance I actually had of catching anything real.
So you took the spines out and asked somebody to run the X-ray diffraction when you were 8?
No. So, I just looked at all the different organs and tried to see how they connected to each other.
And that would be a perfect sort of introduction if you went on for an MD degree or something like that. But
and I initially, that's what I wanted to do. I was going to be a doctor. And then I had this brilliant realization that doctors have to deal with sick people.
All the time. That's right.
And that's not always when people are at their best. And I decided that actually that's not what I liked about science. What I liked was discovering new things. So I changed my path from wanting to be a doctor to wanting to be a scientist.
That was before you went to college or during college?
That was before. I actually got accepted to one of these undergraduate MD undergraduate programs. And I realized at that point, this is not a good choice to lock yourself into this path.
So even the MD, PhD, well, you didn't think of that in those days anyway. That's a little bit early. So as an undergraduate, then you decided a more scientifically oriented. Did you do undergraduate research?
I did. And I started doing undergraduate research in biochemistry because that's sort of where I was coming from. But then I found that I kept not having all the information I wanted. Proteins were treated as blobs, not as molecules, and I wanted to know where the atoms were. And so I just edged towards chemistry, and then from chemistry, I edged towards physical chemistry, and then towards engineering, because that's where the questions that were really interesting.
So what did you do? What was your project as an undergraduate researcher?
Well, I started out doing work on viruses and how viruses evolved, and then I did some work on how organic molecules pack in crystals and what determines the structures of solids. And I like that more. I like to think about molecules and how you put them together. I've always liked to think about how you put things together and build them up into complex things. And that's really what I do now. I build molecules.
And those molecules have particular values and particular interests and particular properties. Tell us what it is that you're trying to build molecules to do, apart from just the pure elegance of structure, because I buy into that completely. But I know that these days you don't write proposals and say, hey, I got this beautiful idea of this vision of this beautiful structural arrangement without the second shoe dropping and says, and these will do the following new materials.
So I have to say, when I started as a faculty member 18 years ago, that was really the beginning of nanoscience. And my research group was mostly focused on building nanoscale architectures for the elegance of structure and how were we able to put molecules together into much bigger structures and control that assembly. But you're right. Now nanoscience has evolved. It's just a tool, not an end in itself. And now we want to make structures that are useful for things. And so my group does a lot of different things. We look at nanoscale materials for use in batteries, particularly looking at batteries that can charge very quickly. We look at organizing polymers or plastics to make low-cost solar cells and put the pieces that are together that are required to generate electricity from plastic materials. You need to mix two kinds of plastics together to effectively generate electricity, and you need to control how they mix. We also work with magnets and how you can organize small size magnets to control their spin state and control how the spins flip around.
Okay. So
we do a lot of stuff.
Right. I don't think we're going to get into spin states because that gets a bit erudite. And, people have got to know about electrons and ups and downs and numbers and even numbers. But
But it's a great area for small structures.
Give us an example of a material that would make the battery work faster.
So it's not a new material. It's a new architecture. So if you look at a typical battery, so if you look at your cell phone battery, that usually takes a couple hours to charge. And the reason it takes hours to charge is because when the battery is charging, ions, which are atoms that have a charge on them, are actually moving through the solid material of the battery. And when ions move in a solid, they move really slowly, because it's hard to move through a solid object. So the goal of our work is to say, ions are always going to move slowly. Let's let them move really short distances. So let's make really tiny pieces of battery material, but let's make them all interconnected so that we can conduct current through them. But then those ions only have to move very, very short distances in the solid.
You know, we've done some shows on lithium batteries. Are you talking about lithium batteries for automobiles and so on?
We are talking about lithium batteries for automobiles. So those ions would be lithium ions. And if they have to move fractions of a millimeter, it's going to take hours and hours. But if they have to move nanometers, it can take seconds.
So you've got to really make sure that your individual particles don't somehow touch one another.
They have to touch one another. The way a battery works is that you both need to move ions and you need to conduct electricity. And so what we often make is nanoporous networks. So a big piece of a material, fraction of a millimeter size piece of a material, but with zillions of holes all the way through it so that the liquid, most of you probably have experienced taking a battery and breaking it, and it's full of liquid that will drip out on you. So what you want is that liquid to be able to move all the way through the holes in the material, but then the active part of the battery to be only nanometers in dimension.
Well, one of the stumbling blocks there is the electrolyte. How do you get the lithium from the cathode to the anode and back and forth? What's in between?
So the materials that we make have the exact same structure of a traditional battery. So they have a liquid electrolyte that separates the anode and the cathode. They have a separator. But then within the anode and the cathode, instead of having big chunks of material that are a fraction of a millimeter in size, we have pieces of a material that are, again, a fraction of a millimeter, but they're filled with holes.
But you have a liquid electrolyte.
That goes into the holes.
Okay. And the reason I'm asking that is I used to work on lithium batteries, and the electrolyte we used to use was explosive, dangerous. Lithium perchlorate and ether is, you know, that's going back many years, but I'm curious as to what the electrolyte is today, liquid.
It's the same as what's used in current battery technology. So it's various lithium salts, not always perchlorates because they are a little reactive, and then a range of cyclic ethers. So it's the same kinds of materials that current lithium-ion batteries are using. So we're not changing that part of it.
So the idea to take these porous nanomaterials, this is something that was in the literature, or was this one of your innovations?
No, no. So this is actually, it's an interesting story as to how this has evolved. So there is a concept called pseudocapacitance, which basically means you do the reaction of a battery just at the surface of a material. And that's a concept that has been known for 20 years, that you could do a battery reaction only at the surface of a material, and it would be very fast. But nobody really defined what is surface. Is surface one layer of atoms? Is surface 100 layers of atoms? And so what we've been doing is defining what is surface. And it turns out surface is not one layer of atoms if you design the system right, and we now are really starting to understand what materials work the best. Surface can be 100 or 1,000 layers of atoms into the material. Now, if you have a piece of material that's a fraction of a millimeter, that's still a tiny, tiny fraction of the material. But if your material has nanoscale dimensions, that can be every atom in the system is active in your battery.
And does that make for greater efficiency, or is that just a matter of mass?
That means that you can combine power density, which means energy per time, with energy density, which means energy per mass. It used to be that if you wanted to go fast, you had very little capacity. Or if you wanted a lot of capacity, you had to go slow. And our goal is to give you the best of both worlds. And I think this is something that is going to be a reality soon.
That was the next question, because, I mean, batteries and their ability to be charged, solar-powered charging of batteries, that seems to me the future of a lot of transportation, for example.
Well, I don't know.
Oh, you
don't?
Okay.
So, I mean, solar has its own issues, and But clean electricity, there's a lot of ways to generate it. The problem is now, if you want an electric car, you have to have an electric charging station, which probably means you need a house and you need to be able to build that charging station into your house. If you want to make electric vehicles accessible to everybody, you need to be able to drive up to a charging station, plug in your car, and in about the time it would take to fill your gas. But if you can charge in 2 minutes... You know, Basically, people have the patience to fill their car in the time it takes to wash their windows.
Well, I mean, you said that what you've got to do is go to find a charging station, but there are more and more of these around. I mean, I go to a lot of universities, even here in El Paso, we have parking lots where you just go and plug your car in, and it's free. The university is paying for it, which is very nice.
Which is great.
Yeah.
If you...
But it's only two out of, 10,000 cars.
But that's why it's free, and that's why it's available. When all cars are electric, it's not going to be free anymore, and you're going to need to pay for the electricity. And in that case, you're going to go to a filling station, just like we go to a filling station now. But if you could electrically charge your car in 2 minutes, the same model that we currently use to fill gas tanks with gasoline, we could use to charge batteries.
Where are we, and how long does it take to charge your typical battery that would be useful for doing significant work other than just the telephone?
So I would say in our lab, a battery has two halves. It has an anode and a cathode.
Right.
We got anodes down. So we've got anodes that would work. We don't quite have cathodes down yet. So I would say when we get cathodes to perform as well as anodes, the technology is commercializable.
And you did a patent on your half of the cell?
On the basic idea of the nanoscale architecture. We have done that.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And our guest today is Sarah Tolbert from the University of California, Los Angeles. And we're talking about all the wonderful things that can, in the future, come from electrically generated batteries. We'll be back in one moment when we've recharged. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Sarah Tolbert, UCLA material scientist. And we were talking about this business of creating new lithium batteries, high efficiency. Do you have any problems like they're always having in airplanes where your little batteries, for reasons unknown to you, suddenly conflagrate?
So the issue that happened in airplanes came from the fact that the way those batteries charged, they got very hot, and the liquid that is in the battery is flammable. I have to say that the batteries we are working with use the exact same liquid. And so what we are doing does not address that problem at all. There's some really interesting work out there where people are coming up with ways to have battery systems that are either not flammable or where you can basically shut down their ability to conduct when they get too hot. And so there are ways to address that, but we're not working on that research project.
Let me ask a question, too, because this idea of having charging stations also reminds me of the hydrogen engine, where for a while they were talking about having an engine that just burned hydrogen, and then you had some storage capacity for the hydrogen in your fuel tank. But you got to go somewhere and get it pumped up. Whatever happened to the hydrogen engine?
So hydrogen fuel cells, which was the basis of the hydrogen engine, are still out there. The fuel cell technology actually has advanced very nicely. The problem is really mostly the ability to effectively store the hydrogen. We can't do that well yet. People are still working on it. You know, the challenge with science in this country is that there's a lot of politics in it. And there was a big push for the hydrogen economy, and there was a lot of money in hydrogen storage. And then that waned in the political view, and there's a lot less money, and so there's a lot less research. So the answer is, I'm sure we could solve the hydrogen storage problem. We're doing some work on it, but I don't think any of it's at the point where I would.
We had some hydrogen donating molecules, so you would have to have two tanks. One with the molecules pumped up and one with the empty molecules, and then you got to send them back to the refinery.
Well, that's one way to do it. You really want to do some onboard method. And there's lots of ideas, but there hasn't been the investment right now, and so there hasn't been the progress.
You bring up that sort of contentious issue that there's a lot of politics in science, right? And politics is interacting with the public to a large extent. And I think scientists, we don't do a particularly good job at talking about what we do and what the important issues are to the lay public, right? Or even back into the high schools. You have a very active program in taking, in your case, nanotechnology, et cetera, into high schools, which is a venue where, you know, that's not very normal. Do you like to tell us about those sorts of activities that you're doing?
Sure. So I have for almost 15 years now directed the California Nanosystems Institute High School Nanoscience Program. So this is an interdisciplinary institute at UCLA that aims to bring together physical scientists, biological scientists, and engineers to work on issues related to nanoscience and nanoscale structures. And as part of that, we want to introduce the public to the ideas of nanoscience. What interesting things can you do if you make things small?
And the principle there is to take away the concept that what scientists do and what they create is some form of magic. You want to sort of bring it down and say, this is the basis from which we are going forward.
So what we do is we develop experiments that can be done in high schools and now more recently junior highs, and that teach fundamental concepts of physics, chemistry, and biology, but just using nanoscale materials. And I work with a phenomenal group of graduate student and postdoctoral scholar volunteers. Everyone in the program is a volunteer. And we work to develop new experiments based on cutting-edge science that we can then teach to high school teachers. We give them supplies, and then they can do these experiments in their classroom. And we work with a very broad range of high schools from throughout the greater LA area, many teachers from definitely underserved neighborhoods. And they come to UCLA, they learn some really exciting science, and then they bring it back to their classrooms. And so we can reach many, many more students through a high school teacher program than we could by working directly with high school students.
So reaching a large number of people, what's the sort of outcome? Do you have clear understanding that that outreach is actually having an impact?
So that's always a challenge,
yes.
Okay? Because there's huge limitations on even what you can do to poll students, because you're not, you know, that's basically doing a research study on students. If you ask them what they've learned. So we have some information. So we have lots of anecdotal information. Students who've sent us emails and said they loved learning about nanoscale solar cells or batteries. There's a number of high schools in the LA area, particularly in underserved communities, who have developed whole nanoscience programs based around our experiments. There are a number of schools that have integrated these experiments into their core science curriculum. And there's a number of schools who have used these as the basis for after-school science activities.
I think that works very well. I've had high school teachers in my course that went back to their high school and had 20 students over the weekend making solar cells that we were working on.
Yeah. We visited some of these workshops where, you know, there's 100 inner-city LA kids making nanostructured solar cells that really work.
So where do you see that will continue? I mean, this institute that you're running, where does the funding come from that? Because, you know, sending graduate students out to there and everywhere, they need remuneration. So who funds this?
So the California Nanosystems Institute itself provides some funding. The graduate students all volunteer their time. So it's an almost entirely volunteer effort. There's a phenomenal group of students at UCLA who would like to do something to give back to the community. But they say, I don't know anything but science. And so given an opportunity to use their science to give back to the community, they're happy to volunteer their time. But then the other thing that we do is we run a summer program for high school students. We have a number of scholarships, but for other students, we charge them. And we actually make some money on the summer program, and we use the profits to buy the kits that we then give to all the high school teachers.
So they come in, they're paying, they get a certificate at the end of completion.
They actually get
like
two UCLA credits.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. So then that's worth paying for.
They're all sort of fuzzy, not particularly useful credits, but they can be that they get a transcript that they can use when applying to college. I mean, they are UCLA credits. They're not in a major.
Most undergraduate degree programs have fuzzy units that people get. But tell us, you know, in your estimation, we've had many ladies on this program of an older generation who told us about the difficulties that they had at the beginning of their careers breaking into science, breaking into academe, breaking into the research posture. And I've assumed that, you know, as we've gone on over the last, say, 5 years, more and more females are becoming in positions like yourself. Is it true for me to think that this is becoming much less of a problem, or do you see through your contact points that, no, we've still got a lot of effort to make to bring women fully into the science enterprise?
I think that there's not specific barriers. I don't think anybody cares if you're male or female in science anymore. I think the only challenge is just that there's not enough hours in a day to do everything that you want or need to do.
And do it well.
Yeah. So I have two children, and I should say it cuts into my husband's time just as much because I certainly do not take care of our children in a vacuum. But in general, it's easier to be a professor if you have somebody staying at home and doing all the work to take care of your children. And if you don't, you do a little less sleeping and a lot less reading of good books.
So, in fact, you think that we're on the right track for being more inclusive to females and then, by definition, also other underrepresented groups?
We're on the right track, but we're not there. I would say that in terms of work-life balance, the university system hasn't figured that out. But I think many, many possible high-tech jobs have also not figured that out in terms of allowing people to do a really great job at an intellectually stimulating career, but still have enough hours before they collapse in exhaustion.
Let me ask you a question about that. Do you know Arthur Bienenstock, who was the from Stanford University, head of the synchrotron laboratory and all that? He wrote an article for a physics magazine recently that said that university administration duties that you have to do have increased so much that they were shutting down the university capability to produce research. Have you seen that?
Definitely. The amount of work that I do that has nothing to do with being a scientist is huge. There used to be administrative assistants in the university, and now they're not. And so now, in addition to being a teacher and a researcher and to spending a really large amount of time trying to raise grant money to support research because there's a lot less money.
You would say that your productivity was greater, let's say, 10 years ago.
Oh, certainly, because we do a lot more administrative work as faculty, work that does not need to be done by a scientist. And we also spend a lot more time trying to raise funds. And if you then add children on that, you've gone over a 24-hour day without sleep.
And we've gone over a 28-minute period. We all have these duties that we seem irrelevant to our careers to do, but you're coping quite well, young lady, right? So, Sarah Talbot, Professor of Materials Science in the Department of Chemistry at UCLA. It's been absolute pleasure talking to you. Come back when you've done the other half of your battery.
We will do that, and hopefully it will be soon. Joy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Thank you out there for listening, and we'll be back.